understanding is now that that's on, it's recording. So we'll go from here. So this talk is really about what is a mine like, mining and manufacturing phosphorus fertilizers. At Mosaic, we use this as a great tool to talk to customers and talk to retailers about what goes into making a ton of MAP or DAP fertilizer. And once people see how this operation works and all the different things that are involved, it really puts an impression on them whenever they're making those fertilizer decisions. And so one of the things that we were hoping to do today was just share a virtual mine tour of sorts with the audience in the symposium today about what goes into mining and manufacturing fertilizer products. And so we'll start off with phosphate. First, I just want to share where some of the phosphate deposits are in North America. I will try really hard to represent the other phosphate producing companies in North America. We have fertilizer or phosphate rock produced in Idaho and Utah. We also have some in North Carolina, and then in Florida. Mosaic operates completely mining in Florida, or at least in North America, that is. And so all of us is in what they call the Bone Valley area of Florida, and we'll talk a little bit more of that. PCS operates in North Carolina and in northern Florida, and then Simplot and some others out in Idaho and Utah. So the one I'm more familiar with is the Central Florida Phosphate Deposit. It was the largest deposit in North America. It's been around for quite some time. Millions of years ago, Florida was covered in water. It was ocean. There was a rich area of phosphate that as the currents came around the Gulf of Mexico, it deposited a lot of phosphate material there. There's actually a ridge on between Tampa and Orlando. If anybody's ever driven I-4, there's a little ridge there, which is where the old shoreline used to be. So the currents would come around there, and you know, all of Tampa and east of there or west of there was underwater. And so that's where these deposits came from. Over time, as the shark and all these marine life decayed, the phosphate deposits built up along with the chemicals that were in the ocean at the time. And then the sea level dropped. Sand covered up that layer that was there, and it created this body or matrix, as we call it, which is what we mine today. And so scientists confirmed in the early 1800s that, you know, we all know that phosphorus became an essential plant nutrient. And then in 1881, you know, the largest phosphorus deposits were discovered in what, like I said, what we call the Bone Valley of Florida. So then what happened is that a guy by the name of Captain James Francis LeBaron first discovered phosphate in Florida, and in 1889, the first phosphate company mined the first commercial product. So that's a long time that we've been mining phosphorus rock in Florida. Polk County was the boom. It's where it really started in 1890s, bringing many mines and company owns. There at one point in time, there were several hundred phosphate companies in the central part of Florida. Now in that particular area, there's one, and so it's a big difference in what it was back at the time. And now as those reserves are mining out, if you think about that area from Tampa to Bartow and in that area, most of that area has been mined out and the deposit's moving further south. And so it's a little bit deeper and it's a little bit different mineralogy, but that's where the mines are happening today. This we'll go into now an overview of the mining process. So this talk will be split up into two sections. One is around mining and what goes into the mining process, and then the second part will be about manufacturing. So how do we take that rock after we mine it and turn it into phosphate fertilizer? So we use drag lines. So our field operations is all around drag lines, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. We take that ore body. We go through what we call a beneficiation process, or we strip out the sands and the clays from that ore body, keep the phosphate material there, and then take the phosphate rock and take it on to processing. What you can see here is as it goes to a washer, the phosphate rock pebble, there's different sizes of phosphate rock, so we have what we call pebble, and then the smaller particles. The pebble is washed out immediately as a part of the washing process. The smaller particles go with the sand over to the sizing area. And then the clay is removed and sent back to a clay settling area. And so all of these things we'll talk a little bit more about today, but this is really what it is. And then this is a very water-intensive process. So we use water to move the ore from the mine site where the drag lines are operating over to the beneficiation plant. And it's used all throughout the process, from the washing process to the sizing to flotation, back to the clay settling areas, and then move it back in again to move the rock again. So it's a really water-intensive process. We do have to discharge a little bit, and that's managed and regulated very carefully by the government. And then, but the good thing about Mosaic, and one of the things that we're really proud of, is that 90% of our water is reused and recycled at our Florida facilities. So we have a lot of people working a lot of hours trying to figure out how to manage water, how do we keep our clay settling ponds at the right depth or the right amount of water and volume inside there, keeping water moving throughout the whole process. So I mentioned the primary method for mining in Florida is drag lines. These are monster machines that weigh over 7 million pounds. When we stand up next to these machines, we don't even get to the top of the tires. Or, you know, our heads don't get to the top of the tires. The boom length on these drag lines is 325 feet long. That's longer than a football field. That's just the boom that carries the bucket out to whenever we're scraping out these mines. An empty bucket weighs about 100,000 pounds and can hold 65 cubic yards. To give you some perspective on that, you can drive a 15-passenger van up in the middle of one of these buckets and still have room to walk all the way around it and on top of it. So they're quite large, they're very heavy, and they move. One of the things that's really interesting is they're powered by DC power, so they're 7,200 volt alternating power, alternating current. They're all electric driven. There's no combustion going on these big giant drag lines, and it takes two people to operate one. This is the view from the cab of the drag line, and you can see the bucket out in front of him. And this just gives you some of the breadth of this and then the size of the bucket there. Another slide just shows shows people walking up to a drag line. This just gives you a perspective there. When we have to move a drag line moves about 1 foot per minute or 1 to 2 foot per minute. So it takes a long time to move these pieces of machinery any kind of distance. Whenever we have to cross a road, we have to build special thing. We have to close the road down, put a bunch of soil up on top of the road, and basically build a bridge across that road out of material to keep from damaging the road. So there's a lot of work of moving drag lines around. And in some cases, we have to, if we have to move a long distance, we'll have to disassemble it and reassemble it at the new location, which can take a matter of years, not just a couple weeks. So drag line mining is very, very labor intensive, and it's really impressive to me whenever we go out there. And this is one of the things that I can say that farmers and retailers really, really enjoy going on these mine tours is they all love equipment. And whenever you go and see equipment like this, they really have a good appreciation for what that does. We do have one dredge mine. So whenever the ore body gets too deep that we can reach with a drag line, we can use a dredge. The dredge is a boat that floats out in the water in a man-made pond, and we can control the depth of that dredge by how much water is in the pond. So if we want to go a little bit deeper, we lower the water of the pond. If we're too low or too deep, then we can raise the water of the pond and do all that. So we manage dredge mining through water management. And basically what it is this rolling machine right here that spins and sucks in that ore body into the thing, and then it's pumped back out up to the surface and into the process that way. So we have a mine in the southern part of our mining territory where we use this. It's called Windgate. But it's another form of that mining that we use. The dredge's ladder is suspended 90 feet underwater. We have a cutter that frees the phosphate from the ore deposit, and then the mine ore at different depths. The new dredges use less fossil fuel, LED lighting, and are quieter. One of the things that you'll find throughout, I think, all of our presentations is all of our companies are focused on trying to reduce energy and the cost of doing these, using this and reducing our impact on natural resources. So a lot of things going on there, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Clearly, this is not Florida. This is a picture from our friends at Simplot where they mine, and they do it another way, right? So it's more of a bucket system, and it's in more of a hill type environment, from what I understand. And so there's other ways to mine phosphate rock. This is another picture of the type of miners that they use to extract the phosphate ore from their deposits. So we have this land in Florida. Mosaic is somewhere around the second or third largest private landholder in the state of Florida. We have a lot of land. A lot of it's already been mined. It's been reclaimed. But what we do is, and so this is just an area where, how do we go find it? We prospect for phosphate deposits. You can see them drive the truck out. They find the phosphate ore. The phosphate ore is the what they call the matrix right here, where it's phosphate, sand, and clay. Once the next step in that process then is we bring in the drag line, and we have to remove the overburden. So that overburden can be 15 to 30 feet of sand that's usually on top, sand and sometimes clay that's on top of that matrix. We remove that overburden with the drag line, place it in another spot, open up that area, what we call the matrix, and then that's what they mine. So you can see the overburden now is moved over to the side, and now they are, they're mining the matrix layer right there. So this is just an example of how they do that. There's a diagram that's coming up in a second that'll show how that drag line moves throughout the field. But you know, sometimes we're not always just mining the matrix, right? Sometimes the drag lines are operating and just moving overburden, and that can go sometimes a couple days at a whack. So there's a lot of time and planning that goes into that, and how do we make sure that we're continuing to supply the rocks, we build up the right supplies to keep the plants operational going forward. This is an example. So this is the mining cut. The cut is what they call, that's the width of that matrix that they're taking out. It's about 320 feet wide. You can see the overburden here was 30 feet. The matrix was about 10 feet thick. And then there's a hard rock bottom, either dolomite or limestone clays that are underneath that matrix where that was deposited. So that's what it looks like. Whenever we're in an active mining site, we have to protect what's around us. So we have a ditch and a berm, so a recharge ditch and a berm system with a silt fence, so that we make sure that there's no way that if a 1 in 100 year flood event comes, that we don't impact some of the other areas around us. So there's a lot of work that goes into preparing a site for active mining so that we don't protect and harm the environments around us. Sensitive areas are set back from mining activities, and then we have, like I said, we separate those with a ditch and a berm. So this slide is an aerial shot. Hopefully you can see the drag line right here. This is the area that's already been mined, and you can see how that drag line moved through that particular patch of land to take the ore out of there. And all the time it's leaving that overburden in different spots as you move throughout this particular field. And so that's the process, and then that's how we do that. And then you mine out a field and you get to the end of that, and then you move on. And then once we finish out a field, well, that's just the first part of the mining process. We still have to do a couple of things. First, before I get there, we have to take and we have to move that matrix to the beneficiation plant. And so we do that through water. And so this is a high-pressure water gun. It's these guys sit in a little building, and it's just like almost like a guy playing a video game. He's got two little joysticks, and he's just sitting there, and all he's doing is pumping this water and slurrying up that matrix. And then it goes into the piping system and gets pumped back to the beneficiation plant. So we move all that through pumps. These lines, if you've ever been in Florida, if you've ever seen some of these lines, they're 18 to 24 foot in diameter pipe. There's pumps that pump 2 to 3,000 tons per hour. It could be several miles from the mining site, the active mining site, back to the beneficiation plant. And for every mile, we need a pump. So every time we go a mile, you'll see a pump and a new pump to keep everything moving. And these pump impellers can be up to 62 inches in diameter. So we're moving a lot of water with this ore body, and it's all going through the mine to the beneficiation plant. At the beneficiation plant, like I said, we remove the oversized materials. We produce the pebble phosphate. Just as the first mine that was mined back in the 1800s that was primarily used was the pebble form of the phosphate. And so that was what they were using in the early days. Since then, we've had a lot of new technologies come out where we can extract the other pieces of phosphate. And so flotation comes into play. We scrub out the clay. We put in some organic materials that attach to the phosphate material so we can float it out and separate it from the sand. And so that the sand then moves and it gets pumped back to the mining site for reclamation. This is a picture of the flotation plant. This picture on the bottom here, those are the fins that spin in a circular motion and push that ore body out to the edge and claims that and separates the sand and floats to the top and is skimmed off. Pumps sand back to the field for the reclamation. there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the beneficiation and in the end product. The clay that's moved out in the washing process is sent to clay settling areas. And so a lot of times you'll see clay settling areas. They're a large pond and a rectangular shape usually, where that water is pumped back into that clay settling area. Up here at the top you can see the clay settle out as the water moves from one end to the other end, and that's where we discharge the clean water back out. And so as we separate those clays out over time, we build up basically a mountain of clay. And that clay is extremely wet and holds water for a very long time. It can take up to 25 or 30 years for a clay settling area to dry out. And so it's a long time to use that, to be able to use that material in some other form, in some other productive way. So that's what we're doing and how we manage our clay that we pull out of that. Then you can see the water come back and it gets returned back into the process. And so again, Mosaic's all about recycling our water and moving the water back around and continuing to use it. Again, 90% is reused and recycled at our facilities. Any water releases must meet the National Pollution Discharge system. And this is just an example of water going back in and all the testing that is done to make sure that we meet those requirements. Then we have the transport basically through rail from our beneficiation plants. It's piled up. This is a giant phosphate rock pile right here in the top right corner, where we can load in rail cars and in a very fast fashion. We can load 200,000 rail cars, a 200,000 pound rail car in about 45 seconds. We Mosaic has its own rail systems that we use, the Mosaic EnviroMotive. So again, it's around reducing energy and reducing our carbon footprints to move product from one place to another. Since 1975, all mining lands, and all phosphate mining lands anyway, are required to be reclaimed. So you can almost tell when a property was mined by whether how well it's been reclaimed or not. And so a lot of times it wasn't reclaimed back in the early days, but since 1975 it's been required, and there's a lot of permitting that goes on with that. Sand is returned back to the mine cuts to be used. Overburden is contoured, so there's a lot of bulldozers and dump trucks and things moving soil and sand around. The land is revegetated, typically back to the same vegetation that was there prior to the mining starting. So if it was a wetland or if it was a native grass area, then it would be returned back to that same type of vegetation. Reclaimed land has many uses: lands and lakes, scrub habitats, wetlands, wildlife, even residential and agricultural uses. And so there's a lot of different ways in which land can be reclaimed and put back into use. One of the things that a lot of people maybe don't understand is what goes in to being able to get the right to mine some land in Florida, or land anywhere. And so the picture, the diagram on the bottom right shows all the different agencies that you have to go through to be able to mine phosphate rock in Florida. So starting with the EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, to Fish and Wildlife and the state agencies, all the way down to the county governments. And so we have teams and teams of people who's nothing, their whole job is to just get the permit for the next piece of land that needs to be mined. And so we Mosaic invest a lot in our communities in Florida to be able to continue to operate that way. And we play a big role, hopefully, in improving the economy of the Bone Valley area of Florida and doing a lot of things to invest in that area as well. So then we're going to now transition from the mining of phosphate rock to how do we take that rock and turn it into a fertilizer. This is more the chemistry lesson of the session today, to where we have the capacity to produce about 11 million metric tons a year of finished product, MAP and DAP being predominant sources of those, and how do we get to making those products is what we're going to talk about next. So the manufacturing process, there's three core areas where we have sulfur, phosphate rock, and anhydrous ammonia. All these things go into the production of phosphate fertilizer. So we have phosphate rock storage, ammonium storage, and now this is where we'll spend a little bit more time. So the first thing we do is we have to make sulfuric acid. So we take sulfur, we purchase a lot of sulfur, we're one of the largest buyers of sulfur in the whole world. We take that sulfur, we have a whole plant, at all of our production facilities we have sulfuric acid plants where we make sulfuric acid. We then take during that production of sulfuric acid, we generate a lot of heat. By doing that, we have a cogeneration plant, so we produce electricity with the creation of our sulfuric acid plants. That powers 90% of the electricity that we need throughout our whole process, whether it's from those big drag lines to running the chemical plants to all the reclamation work and everything else that we're doing. We provide our own electrical energy to do that. We then take that sulfuric acid and we use it to produce phosphoric acid. So we take it and react it with the phosphate rock, producing phosphoric acid and gypsum. It depends on the concentration of the phosphate ore, but for every ton of phosphate rock, we're producing about 3 to 3.5 tons of gypsum that we then have to manage that separately too, right? So we're producing a lot of byproduct whenever we make our phosphate fertilizers. Once we have phosphoric acid, we can do, depending on the product that you want to make from that phosphoric acid, you do a couple of things. You take it to a granulation plant. That's where we make MAP and DAP fertilizers. Some producers sell it as acid, whether it's phosphoric acid, merchant grades, SPA, superphosphoric acid that's used in some of the liquid fertilizers, or even purified acid that's used in the food market. And then thirdly, animal feed products are made from phosphoric acid as well. In the granulation plant is where we use ammonia to make our ammoniated phosphates. So we'll talk just a little bit more about what that granulation plant looks like. We talked already about the gypsum stack and the power process. So this is what a really, really crude version of what granulation looks like. So you can see this is a granulator here in the bottom right-hand corner. I don't have my cursor. There it is. So in the bottom right-hand corner, that's a granulation. Some of those would be 16 feet across or in diameter. They're spinning, and we produce the product there. The phosphoric acid comes in this stream. It goes into a pre-neutralizer, or sometimes it's called a reactor, where we're starting with a straight phosphoric acid. We start to put ammonia in there and get it up to a certain mole ratio, and then we put that into the granulator. So that's the line, the next line, where it goes up from the pre-neutralizer up into the granulator, and then we have an ammonia sparger in the granulator to bring it up to either monoammonium phosphate or diammonium phosphate. So as you remember, each of the different processes, and then so we make monoammonium phosphate has one mole of ammonia for every mole of phosphate. Diammonium is 2, so depending on what product we're making decides what we're putting in that pre-neutralizer. So how do we want to react that phosphoric acid with how much ammonia before we send it to the granulator and then finish it off in the dry product? So if we look at a curve of when phosphoric acid and ammonia turn solid, there's 2 peaks, one at mono, one at one mole, and 1 at 2 moles. And so you want to be somewhere in between those 2 peaks in a liquid form before you get into the granulator, and then you use ammonia to get back up to make it turn into a solid. Another key point about granulation is that when product comes out the end of the granulator, it's not all the perfect size. And so there is a lot of what we call recycle that goes on in the granulation process. And so, of the product that comes out, it goes through different screens and sizing mechanisms to get to that 2-millimeter product that everybody likes to use in the marketplace. And to be able to achieve that, we're sending about, it depends on, again, plant and product, but over half of that product goes back into the recycle. So that means we have to produce twice as much to get to the final finished grade product that we're trying to produce. So, there's a lot of material that gets crushed back up. All the overs get crushed and put back into the process, and then used as seed and put back into the granulator. And so this is it's a really interesting process. If you ever get to go to a granulation plant, you'll see elevators and screens and stuff just moving around everywhere inside those facilities. But the reality is that we're trying to come out with either a mono or diammonium phosphate granule at the end of the process. Talked already about generation, but Mosaic produces with the heat that's generated from the sulfuric acid plants. We create our own electricity. And this is just some of the pictures of some of the turbines and heat exchangers that are used at the plants to capture that steam and to use it to produce use it in the cogeneration plants. Phosphogypsum storage is another big part of what we do is manage that. So I've said earlier we produce a lot of gypsum each year. The state of Florida and the environmental in the EPA do not let us repurpose that particular gypsum, and so it's all stacked up and it's in the mountains of Florida. If you've ever seen those. As you drive across, right? So we have giant hills that are managed and protected. Once the gyp stack reaches its maximum height, then it has to be vegetated and put into some type of a service mode to make sure that we maintain that and keep it moving forward. The Florida Institute of Phosphate Research, FIPRA is what it's called, conducts research on, you know, how we can use this safely. We can use this gypsum going forward, but we still have some work to do to make sure that we try to be able to use phosphogypsum in the United States. And finally, you know, as we think about it, we want to make sure that we produce a quality product. And so technology that's in these chemical plants now is just incredible. You can see this is a picture of an operator with all these screens in front of him. He can track material throughout the whole plant just by sitting in front of these screens, and he knows there's sensors going on everywhere. We're constantly testing the moisture, dust levels, making sure that everything is on grade and on spec so that when we send it out, it goes out and we can ensure and stand behind the product that we're producing. And then lastly, you know, we move a lot of product. And so whenever you think about what Mosaic's doing, what the fertilizer companies are doing to move product, it's at an incredible scale, right? And so, you know, coming from another industry, like in the seed and chemistry industry, when we were working in bags and seed pack 50s and things like that, to talking about fertilizer where you're moving trains or barges or boats, It's just a different scale that's really hard to comprehend, you know, when you're first doing it. And so that's one of the challenges, I think, you know, as we think about what's going on in the fertilizer industry, is that the way that we have to produce fertilizer is just different. And so it's one of our challenges that we face on a day-to-day basis. Just to try to do just a little bit about some numbers for you, about two-thirds of the Port of Tampa's business, the $15 billion business, is directly related to the phosphate industry. So phosphate industry is extremely important to the Tampa area. 71% of the estimated North American annual production of concentrated phosphates is Mosaic, and 14% of the global supply, $2.5 billion export. So fertilizer is one of the key things that goes on in the Florida economy. And the last little bit of numbers here to go on is just stuff that's really, I think, really neat. I mean, 15.3 million metric tons of phosphate rock that's mined in a year, 9.4 million phosphate fertilizers and feeds that's produced, 11.7 million potash fertilizers. Robert will talk a little bit more about that. 1.5 million tons of ammonia consumed. We're one of the world's largest consumers or buyers of ammonia, because we have to pay for every ton of phosphate we produce now, we buy and use ammonia to do that. We use some urea and UAN in some of the processes. 4.3 million metric tons of sulfur. I talked about that a little bit already. And then, you know, we produce 15 million tons of sulfuric acid. Shipping. I talked briefly, just, you know, the number of rail cars, 350,000 rail cars. So the big rail trains, a lot of times are referred to as unit car trains. Those are going to be somewhere in that 80 to 110 cars. This would be, you know, 350 of those trains in a year. That's almost one a day, you know, to give kind of some kind of perspective on that. 375 trucks, river barges, 1,500 river barges. Typically, when we produce fertilizer, put it on a barge, it's about 1,500 ton. So 1,500 tons times 1,500 barges, and you can do the math on that. Containers, vessels can go from anywhere from, you know, 10 to 50,000 tons on a vessel. So there's a lot of product that's moved on a vessel and then managing the warehouse. With that, I got just another minute to go, and I want to thank everybody for your time and hope that the symposium is what you're looking for today and in the meetings. And I'll go ahead, and as Robert comes up, we'll bring up the next talk.